Welcome to Worlds Apart. On the first day of next year, Brazil is set to inaugurate its old new president, who's been sworn into office twice before with the same promises of alleviating poverty and socializing governance. With Lula's return, Latin America still to the left is more pronounced than ever, but will it help in taking social justice from the tired realm of ideology into practical living reality? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Alessandro Golombieschi Teixeira, professor of public policy at Tsinghua's University School of Public Policy and Management. Professor, it's great to see you. Great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Now, on the day of his inauguration, President Lula will be 77, the oldest person on record to assume the Brazilian presidency. I wonder if you see any contradiction between his age and his promises to rejuvenate both Brazil's economy and its society.
No, I don't. I was there in the first inauguration because I was part of his first government. I was part of his transitional team. And I have been following him because now I'm in China and I see the same spark, same energy, same wish to make Brazil difference. What we need to call attention is that when he starts his first mandate in 2003, January of 2003, Brazil was almost in the same situation where we are now. A lot of poverty, crime related to poverty, situation was not very good. We've been through a lot of economic turmoils, and I think he's back to the same point. And of course, I was in the government of Brazil for 13 years, and seeing everything that we have done, everything that we worked very hard in almost one decade and a half, to go back, it's a very hard situation. So I think despite his age, he is in, I would say, on fire to change everything, and I think also to be part of the history of Brazil.
Absolutely. And he also seems to be in a very good shape. Before we discuss the particulars of Brazilian and Latin American politics, let me ask you one more question about age, because it's not just in Brazil, but in many other countries, the United States, China, Turkey, Russia, to name just a few. We have tried and tested leaders, people who are roughly 70 years of age, who've been in politics for quite some time, and yet they're now tasked with navigating their countries through very fast changes. How do you explain that phenomenon? Because generally, we think about older people as not very adaptable.
I think there is two important elements of that question. You know, it's a trick question. Why? Because although I support that we need to renovate, we need to bring in people to lead, because we do have a governance problem in the world. That's clear. Look COVID-19, look the crisis in terms of climate change. So we don't find answers. So maybe the generation that is, the back generation with 60 years old, they are not trained or tested enough to steer the boat in the conditions that we are. So people they see, like Joe Biden, President Xi, President Lula, with people that they trust, that did well in the past. So I believe there is a psychological element, but also an element of a formation of those cadres that we need to have in more, I would say, more up-to-date. Although the world is changing fast, I think our leadership is not changing fast. So let's see, it's a dichotomy that we need to deal with it. Because the young presidents like Macron or like Trudeau, if you see their performance, they are not as what they told they would be.
As you pointed out in one of your articles recently, as a Brazilian citizen, you feel happy that Western democracy still works, at least as you said, in Latin America. And that sounds very cheeky. Do you mean to imply that in other parts of America, Western democracy doesn't work?
Yeah, what I imply that the concept, we can get a philosophical debate here, but what is the concept of Western democracy, right? The majority choose its leaders. The case of the United States is a good example. The majority does not choose its leaders because the majority, the former elect president Trump was not the majority. The majority has choosing Hillary, not him. So in other places around the Western hemisphere, we have that. For example, if we go to Europe and we see the votes to be prime minister or of England, prime minister, they are elected with 20% of the vote of the population. So this does not call for the concept that we like to use in Western. So in the case of Brazil, that's an example. In the case of Colombia is an example. In the case of Mexico, the majority of the population has voted for this president. Mm-hmm. So that's my point. That's my strong point on this.
But, you know, a couple of years ago, I myself had a chance to interview President Lula, and he said at that time, I think it was 2019 probably, that he had no doubt about the support for him among the common folks, but he was complaining that the Brazilian ruling class cannot do anything without first consulting with the United States. So essentially, many of the decisions in his view at that time were outsourced to the decision makers in Washington. Do you think that is still a problem in Brazil? And if so, how do you think he should address it?
So I think that's another discussion in terms of how Latin America builds its modern economics, right? We had for some time a dependence of the United States. It's not to say dependence, but we have a direct relation. So when you're talking about the right wing, or the dominant elite in Latin America, they tend to see United States as their dream achieved. But I think it's not only United States. We have this in different countries, even in Russia. Mm-hmm. We know a good part of the elite of Russia before or during the perestroika moment, they flew to United States. In other, even in China, they do that. So because the United States is this marketing dreaming place. So I think it's natural for Latin America to have that because you are close. So President Lula was worried that we try to Americanize politics too much. So in the case of foreign affairs, for example, that's what he was mentioned, we have what we call direct alignment with the policies that comes from Washington, not only from the Washington consensus, but even later on. And in our view, in the President Lula view, in the left of Latin America, we need to negotiate eye to eye. We need to respect. Doesn't matter if you're a big or a small country. We need to be at the same level. And that's what President Lula is going to fight for. That's what Latin America wants to. We are not the backyard of the United States. We are not the front yard of the United States. We are neighbor, and we need to respect each other.
Now, as you pointed out, with Lula's victory, the six largest economies in Latin America, Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, Chile, Colombia, and Peru, are now governed by the leftist parties, not counting other countries like Cuba and Bolivia and Honduras, who have had that trajectory for quite some time. Now, as a person who was born in the Soviet Union and I think was conditioned to sort of be somewhat shameful of my country's socialist past, I want to ask you specifically, how do you think the left of the 21st century will be different from the left of the 20th century? And are there any lessons that have to be kept in the front of politicians' minds?
I think the good news for the left is that we understand that the world is changing rapidly. Social movements, they change rapidly. Before, when we were talking about left, you were talking about economic model and a political model. Many people talk now about left, not about economic model, meaning we're going to be in capitalism, but how we improve that, mm-hmm. who control the production sector. So My point here, when we are talking left in Latin America, is that we don't want to challenge capitalism. It's not the point for the left of Latin America. We want to change capitalism. That's a little different. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we know that this takes time. Even Karl Marx, when he was writing, he started writing about capitalism. He was not writing about communism or socialism. So there is an evolution in that process. So the most important for the left is that the capitalism in Latin America, because it's a developing region, was what we call wild capitalism. Mm-hmm. So money buys everything. Money is the most important. So you forget the life of the citizens. So the left in Latin America understand that we need to teach and we need to work in a system that the first to be care of is the citizens. So we need to understand that. And of course, you have modernization of the economy, digitalization, climate issues. So all this, I think the left is up to discuss. And that's why we, as you cited, we have the majority Latin American, because people, they know we need someone that is there to care the people, mm-hmm. to care for the people, not about money.
But you also suggested in your writing that this new turn to the left has an international dimension. You suggested that President Lula can formulate a joint plan for developing countries in this new era. And it's an interesting thing to think about, because over the last couple of decades, the developed world excelled in offering various developmental frameworks to the third world countries, the frameworks that more often than not were used to serve the benefactor rather than beneficiary. Do you think Brazil and other countries will be able to resist that temptation to plunder the weaker side? And do you think they will succeed in being sort of fair and measured in the way they share their ideology or their economy with others?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're going to succeed, because that's the world war, if sort of speak. But I believe we're going to fight, because when we are fighting for these elements, we are fighting not for developed country as a term. We are fighting for people. Mm-hmm. We have more than 3.1 billion people living in developing countries. And a large proportion of this, they live in rural areas, and they are in serious situations of hunger. And a very important point, we never had such advancement in technology and productivity to produce food, to produce wealth. And still, we increase hunger. The Director General, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Dr. Guterres, during the United Nations opening in New York, he mentioned that out of the 17 SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, we didn't achieve, or we are not near to achieve any of those. Okay, this is speak by itself. This is the data. And we have there poverty alleviation, rural revitalization, climate change, economic development. So we do have a problem.
We have a minor problem here of taking a short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
I look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
Hello.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Alessandro Golombievski-Teixeira, Professor of Public Policy at Tsinghua University School of Public Policy and Management. Professor, as you mentioned before the break, you held many high-ranking positions within the Brazilian government before taking on teaching. And yet, given your very extensive practical and academic expertise in economics, I wonder if your understanding of how global economy functions, how it succeeds and how it falters, has it changed in any way over the last couple of months? Because many countries think that many countries were exposed to things that they believed were impossible before.
No, I think a person like me that is almost two decades in politics, internal politics in Brazil and international institutions, we are tested. We understand the evolution of the world economy. We understand the evolution of the institution. And for understand that, we need to understand the evolution of the human being and society. That's the point. Society are not an ephemeral concept. It's people. So that's the most important. And before the break, I was telling that we have many problems, and the problems has been raising, like climate change, like epidemic that didn't end, like poverty, like hunger. And those problems, and that's very important, they are not with a single solution. So a country cannot say, I can solve that problem. No, we need to have collective leadership. And that's what I keep telling is missing. We don't have consensus. Everybody is more, of course, this is a side of capitalism, the individual, the selfishness. But we need to understand that we don't get out of pandemic, we don't change climate change for better if we don't work together. Mm-hmm. It is not words, it needs to be action. And that's the point.
Mm-hmm. Now, you pointed in one of your articles that because the West took the lead in the Industrial Revolution and because it led the transformation from national history into world history, people around the world still tend to see Westernization as synonymous with modernity, despite the fact that I would argue it produced many of the problems that you actually cited right now and that brought humanity on the cusp of this ecological and economic disaster. Now, how long do you think the world will subscribe to this notion that despite everything, the West still knows what's best for the rest?
I think it's changing very quickly. We're going to see in the next 5 years or so, Asia, for example, already with 40 to 45% of the global GDP. We see China already as the second economy of the world. Very soon, we're going to see countries that you never heard, at least the Western have heard, like Indonesia, Malaysia, Cambodia, Vietnam, people they don't have in our culture, Europe especially, United States, in the Americans, we don't know very much what is Indonesia, you know. And I always give example in Brazil. Say Indonesia is a country of almost more than 200 million people, and they are composed by 17,000 islands. Okay, 17,000, and they are now the leader of G20 for this year. So we need to pay attention. Malaysia, over 200 million people. So that's very important. And they have a different perspective. They have a different philosophy. We tell the history, we think, and there is a lot of discussion about, let's say, the clash of civilization. And I always say, what is the Western civilization? Is the Americans? Because the North Americans, they are colonized like Brazil was. Remember always that. That's a very important point. United States and Brazil were discovered by the Europeans in the end of the 1400s, okay? The Europeans, they discovered America by a mistake, not by mistake, but because they want to go around the Turkish area, the empire, the Ottoman Empire, because they want to go to where? They want to come to here, to China, to India, to do trade. So we are talking with people like India, like China, that has 3,000, 5,000 years of history.
Absolutely.
So we need to acknowledge that.
Professor, with all due respect, I think the way the Americans or the Westerners want to do business now is a little bit different than it was at those historic times. And one could argue that the global economy as it exists today, or at least as it was envisioned, is sort of based on this idea that the West will provide the rest of the world with technology and finances while getting in return consumer goods and natural resources. And I think one can argue with reliance on data that Western companies or Western countries often use that dominant position to secure better prices, cheaper prices for themselves. So, you know, using your analogy with the colonization, it was always a little bit of a glass beads for gold exchange. Do you think the West, the Western economies, can sustain themselves by themselves without this inbuilt unfair exchange or inbuilt disbalance?
No, it cannot. I'm giving the historical explanation because that's what put us here. But if you look even in the system, if you're talking about the 10 largest banks in the world, you mentioned financial system, at least 5 to 6 are Chinese. Okay. If you're talking about large corporations, let's say technology companies, what we call unicorns, companies that are over 1 billion, we have, let's say, 400, 500 in the world. We have more than 100 Chinese. So I would say the balance of the world economy is getting out from the Western economies to the Asian economy. And there is a change. There is a change of how to do business. There is a change of culture. There is a lot of changes. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the elements I like to talk, you know, let's take a technological platform for the youngsters, right? TikTok. Mm-hmm. If you go to the United States, if you go to Latin America, it's a fever. Everybody uses TikTok, but nobody or very few people knows, at least in Brazil, that TikTok is Chinese. And it starts in China. So these things is changing and will change because these Asian countries, they're going to lead in technology, they're going to lead in production, and they will lead in the service and the platform economy. So that is a change. And that's why United States and Europe are so concerned with China. That's why we have this, it's not a commercial, I say it's a technological tension by the leadership. So that's a very important point that you asked.
Now, you mentioned that they're very concerned. I think that's a very diplomatic term, perhaps owning to your experience in international negotiations, but they seem to be pretty aggressive when it comes to dealing with China. And I don't know if you've seen it, German magazine Spiegel recently published a draft copy of Germany's strategy vis-a-vis China, which explicitly states that they will give the priority to human rights issues and the way they define human rights issues to economic cooperation. And in their interpretation, when it comes to human rights, there could be no cultural or religious relativity that you are talking about. They insist only on their strict vision of how it's supposed to be. Do you think it's a viable framework for cooperation?
No, I think it's a theoretical framework that in reality doesn't sustain. And that's what we saw with the chancellor of Germany came to visit China. If they have this framework to confront China, they know that they will not succeed, or nobody's going to succeed, right? Because, again, they have problems inside Germany about human rights. We don't need to point fingers. Everybody has, I would say, the ceiling, the glass ceiling, right? So that's a very important point. So I think in a pragmatic way, they want to do, it's the same as the United States. They want to do a theoretical framework or a political framework saying we're going to be hard, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But they change. For example, last week during the G20, Joe Biden said that he's not a rival to China. He's a competitor. You see, you're going to calibrate your speech because there is no such a thing as decoupling. Everybody's talking, oh, United States is going to decouple from China. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. Diminish here, diminish there? Yes, but there is no decoupling. Because if there is a decoupling, Americans, they will not have their Christmas. They will not take given. There is not a possibility to have the Halloween party. So that's very important. It's many years of compromising and working together. And if they decouple from China, they go to couple to air, because as I said again, and that's very important, my message to you, there is no anymore I'm doing by myself.
Can I ask you one more thing about the practical realities? Because I know that you held Brazil's effort in the context of BRICS, and this is such an interesting grouping. It was, if I remember correctly, started as essentially a marketing ploy to sell shares of developing countries, but slowly and surely it developed into a viable organization that now seems to expand. How do you see the purpose of BRICS at this point of time? And what do you think this format can offer that other groupings cannot?
It's very good that you're asking, because BRICS is starting a conversation between President Lula and President Medvedev some time ago, right, before 2014. So, and a lot of people would say that this will not be sustainable, because putting countries with such a different background, such a different agenda,
and such different geography. I mean, they're worlds apart, literally.
And my point since the beginning, because I was in the government there, I was in a meeting, is that number one, is viable because we share the same necessity. We share the necessity. BRICS was formed first to give a voice to developing countries, to try to balance more the world between this economic dispute between developed and developing countries, number one. Number two, we learn to respect our difference and work together. And then when we sit between with each other, we know we are strong, we can have a voice. There is a lot of things to be built. So we believe, so for example, when we created the National Development, the New Developed Bank, NDB, we had a debate if it's going to call Bank of the BRICS, right? BRICS Bank. And a lot of people, it was a consensus that we need to start as four countries, then plus five, and then we need to expand, because if the idea was to have a voice for developing countries, we need to open our arms and do something different. Exactly in the question that you asked, institutions, after Bretton Woods, they are molded by Western, one type of Western, Europe and the United States, and they don't work. We need to do that, and the BRICS is one of the important instruments for that.
You mentioned that BRICS became a platform for giving a voice to developing countries, but I'm hearing more and more from various analysts that it's actually became a practical testing ground for how to do trade and business without the Western financial pressure. So essentially testing various ways of circumventing the Western financial and trade infrastructure. Do you agree that it is finding a new purpose right now?
It's a consequence. Why? Because we have different ministerial groups in trade, in investment. So it's a consequence, but was not the objective. And of course, as the objective was to have a better political coordination, political discussion, and was born as a mechanism. That's why you don't have a secretariat. That's why you have a rotating president. Okay. But of course, the consequences is economic consequences. So I hope in the future, that's my personal hope, that we can have a trade, not only bilateral trade, but inside a multilateral trade in the BRICS, where we don't need to commercialize in dollar, where we can use the BRICS currencies to do that. That would be a breakthrough, you know? So that's my expectancy.
Well, Professor, this is all we have time for. Thank you very much for being on our show.
Thank you very, very much. As you said, in Russia, спасибо.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again, same place, same time, on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.